the sun. They get you in the shade.
Linoleum knife. That was Boyce and Hearts, who wrote most of the Monkees hits, and they did their own stuff, and that was the theme song to the Dean Martin, Matt Helm movie, The Ambushers.
Nice.
Which I just threw in for the sheer hell of it. Anyway, welcome to the show. Dave White is in Dallas this week, so I'm Alonzo Duralde from Movies.com. No, he's from Movies.com. God, not enough coffee yet. I'm Alonzo Duralde from TheRap.com and What the Flick. And joy. Why can't. Are you hearing yourself?
I'm not hearing. I'm hearing myself.
What? The disaster. Everything. Oh, maybe because we're not plugged in. That would help. Bam. There we go.
Hooray.
Oh, that makes all the difference. Okay. So as I was saying, I'm Alonzo Duralde from TheRap.com and What the Flick, and joining us this week is our very special guest, Mr. Matt Atchity.
Woo! Thank you, thank you.
Thank you for being here. Matt is the editor-in-chief at RottenTomatoes.com, and my co-host on What the Flick.
Yes,
and
a.k.a. Fat Beardo 2.
That's right, yes. Thanks to those lovely and charming commenters at YouTube.
I love those guys.
We are known as Fat Beardo 1 and Fat Beardo 2, the characters that Dr. Seuss forgot to write.
Every time I'm feeling too full of myself, I start reading comments.
Yes,
it brings me right back down to size.
It does balance things out, yeah. And it's thanks to, being seen with the likes of me that now if you look up Matt Atchity on Google, one of the choices it offers you is Matt Atchity gay.
Yeah, the auto fell. I told you how upset my mom was. Or surprised. She was aghast. I was looking you up on the web the other day to find your videos on YouTube, and said, Matt Atchity gay? What does that mean?
Honey, do we need to talk?
But you just got married.
To a lady. Matt did indeed just get married to a lady.
Yes, and I did.
Now a
or did I?
And is now a proud stepfather. So, several movies to cover this week. Before we really get into it, I have to do some clarifications and corrections from last week. All of which go to underscore the fact that this is a movie podcast and not a Broadway podcast, because when we start talking about Broadway, we have no idea what we're talking about. So if you go to the Linoleum Knife page on Facebook, which if you haven't already liked, you totally ought to should, you will see that listener James was kind enough to point out that they're playing our song is about the relationship between Carol Bayer-Sager and Marvin Hamlisch, not Burt Bacharach. And Duncan let us know that Doug Henning actually was a magician before getting cast in The Magic Show, and that John Rubenstein, and not William Catt, was the original star of Pippin. So, we stand corrected. We will never talk about Broadway again, because down that path lies sorrow and tragedy. You think the gay guys know this stuff just sort of in our DNA,
I thought there was a quiz. Like, you can't come out until...
Yeah, we did not get the laminated flashcards about this topic, so sadly, there you have it. So Matt, explain to me, what exactly does the editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes do? Because I know a large part of what you guys feature on the site is aggregations of other reviews, but... So you're in charge of all the other content?
I'm in charge of... ultimately, if I were to sum it up, I'm in charge of the voice of Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I oversee, how we're writing about movies, how we're talking about things. I do have a staff of editors that, aside from aggregating movie reviews, we are also writing original content. I also, direct the team as to what movies we're going to feature on any given day, what trailers we're going to show, what picture galleries and that kind of thing, as well as help the team define the criteria for inclusion on the tomato meter. It's not just anybody who writes movie reviews.
Sure.
Believe it or not, there are criteria, believe it or not.
There are standards to be met, yes.
They may be low, but no. When I first got there, really the only criteria was if you belong to one of a list of critics organizations,
right.
Pretty much you were in, or you were... a big enough publication you were in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the team and I did was define exactly what those criteria would be, rather than take the attitude which it had been previously, which was, oh, we know it when we see it. Well,
right.
You know, as we've gotten so many critics up, it started to get a little hinky. You know, and there's people who honestly kind of snuck in who, you know, I think that if we were looking at them now, I'm not going to name any names, but, you know, there's probably people who got in as part of certain groups that if they were to apply now, we may not put them on.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's an ever-changing landscape for the whole review thing. I mean, I still remember in the fairly recent past, like in LA Film Critics meetings, when we would be considering new members, there would be a certain sort of like, he writes for the internet.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And now it's sort of like, find the person in this room who isn't writing for the internet.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the thing is 10 years ago, or, you know, I should say actually 13 years ago when Rotten Tomatoes started, you know, it was pretty easy to draw the line between print critics and internet critics.
Right.
But that there's not that luxury anymore. Right. Yeah. I mean, arguably, you know, Ken Turan's getting as many readers online as he is, you know, with his print reviews.
Sure.
Right. Because the newspaper business is dying. Right now, well, I know there's a bunch of people out there who will refute me on that, but
even so, it's like there's a finite number of people who read the LA Times in its print version, but you know his reviews are being read globally on the web. You know?
Right, exactly. I mean, everybody, you know, a lot of the really strong writers are getting syndicated to many, many different places. Which you know, the flip side of that is, and it's something we're keenly aware of, is that local papers. You know, there was a time that the local critic was really important part of the, you know, the local culture, local scene, helping you see movies, helping you discover movies. And as more, you know, the double-edged sword is that as somebody gets syndicated, that could mean that local paper doesn't need a local critic anymore.
Yeah, a lot of newspapers, when they, you know, had to start cutting corners because they weren't ready for the web onslaught, the first thing to go was movie reviewers because they thought, oh, well, you know, I can just run Roger Ebert or Roger Moore out of Orlando or whoever, you know, or Christie on AP because, you know, it's like, well, movies, they're the same everywhere. But yeah, I think there is something to be said about that local voice. I mean, I grew up in Atlanta. I faithfully and religiously read Eleanor Ringel in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And, you know, I mean, I now consider her a friend. But, I mean, like, growing up, she was a real sort of role model for me. And her stuff had a distinctly local flavor to it. Like, when she talked about her, like, she did, I remember, I was reminded of this column a couple of years ago. I was doing a piece for MSNBC about the 50th or 60th anniversary of Gone with the Wind. 60th or 65th, who knows?
It's been around so long.
Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, but she had written this really amazing column about her life experiences with Gone with the Wind, like seeing it when she was 8, seeing it in college, and suddenly going, oh, wait a minute, you know, like, and sort of how she deals with it now as an adult, and from the perspective of a woman who had grown up in the South, I mean, all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it is sad that so much of those voices now aren't around.
Well, and you know, the irony is that you can read the LA critics and you know, I'm painting in broad strokes here, but the LA critics will react differently to a film than the New York critics will.
Oh, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And, you know, it may be subtle differences, but there's a different kind of attitude. And there's a different attitude with the Chicago critics.
I mean,
you know, Roger and Gene Siskel back in the day, like those guys sounded different than the New York hoi polloi, so to speak.
Right.
It's, you know, and I think that we're missing, you know, the local critic in the smaller towns and the smaller cities across the country. Like those are important voices that we're kind of missing. And I wish that, you know, I'd like to see there be a resurgence of that. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but.
Well, at least not in the way that it used to be. I mean, I think where you're going to see that instead is bloggers and other people who have sort of taken to the web to do their opinions. You know, I think a lot, you get a lot of sort of young white college kids or whatever, you know, who think they know everything about movies, even though they haven't seen anything that came out pre The Godfather. But you know, I think if you want to find out like a black woman's perspective, you know, or you know, any number of gay perspectives or Jewish or whatever, you know, or even sort of like what do they think in Indiana, you know, you can find that.
Right, which is why we do allow internet only critics. Like that is an important part. You know, the trick is not having that overwhelm. It's a balancing act that we're constantly working on.
Right. Now, and I'm just curious, you know, when you guys come up against people, like I know there are and not even talking about sort of the one that everyone's thinking of, but other like some, I've seen some critics in Australia pull this kind of thing. The ones who seem to go out of their way to, all they want to do is stop a zero or a 100 in its tracks.
You know, there's so far, there's only one person that we've ever been able to really, really honestly believe is not being honest in their criticism.
Uh-huh.
And this person actually chose to leave the site on their own. You know, we like to think that everyone's being honest. You know, there are certain people that are contrary.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that we talk to them about. And, you know, look, I'm not an editor of everybody's criticism all over the world. Like,
sure.
I don't want to be in that position. You know, I don't expect everyone to agree. You know, if a movie's getting 100% and then, you know, the way we feel anymore is, ooh, so whoever says that, whoever does that first negative is going to get savaged by the users. But really, like, I don't think everyone should agree. I don't know that it's, you know, there's a certain type of user that gets really caught up in seeing a movie be 100. Now, I will say, I will admit that there's a little bit of glee in the office when we see a movie getting a perfect zero. And then somebody takes mercy on it. We're like, oh. But, you know, Schadenfreude strikes us all the time. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, if you can legitimately say that you have a gripe with a movie, or, you know, if you can explain intelligently why you go against the grain,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, as long as we feel like you're being honest.
Well, you know, later this episode, we will be discussing a movie where I'm very much on the minority end of an opinion. But I mean, it's funny. If you look up each critic, it will tell you, like, what their percentages of basically going with the flow on Rotten Tomatoes, like of agreeing with the overall thing. And I'm like in the 70s, so I'm not...
It's pretty good.
And even, you know, let's just say his name, Armand White, is like in the 60s. Like, it's not as bad as you would think it might be, you know. So, you know, even he is not as much of a contrarian as he gets a rap for. But it's just...
Right. Only on the big movies that will get him a lot of attention.
It's the times that he chooses to do it that is what gets noticed. I still am reeling over his Synecdoche, New York review, but, you know, that's a favorite of mine. That him and Rex Reed, they both went to town on that movie.
You say what you will about Armand. Like, you look at what Rex is saying from time to time, and you're like, really? Come on.
Yeah, but he's been like that for decades.
I
still remember when he put Raising Arizona on his worst list, because we're supposed to think kidnapping is funny. I mean, like...
Right. I mean, he's the one who started the rumor about Marissa Tomei not winning the Oscar.
Really?
I mean, oh, that's him. He's the one who started that rumor. Like, you know, for those people that don't know, the rumor is that she didn't legitimately win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for My Cousin Vinny, that her name was the last one
Jack
read.
Jack Palance just read the last name
and they gave it to her. He started that rumor, right? And that is absolutely not true. And really, like, what an asshole. Yes. Can I say
actually, but I'll bleep it later.
All right, sorry.
Good. I should have reminded you. My bad. Anyway, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. And
thank you.
So let's dig in. What do we have this week? The big movie this weekend is Wrath of the Titans.
Wrath of the Titans. Exactly. You know, one of the users on What the Flick called me out for giving Clash of the Titans for a 6.5.
We
reviewed it, you know, and on this review, on our review this week, I was saying, oh, yeah, it's better than the first one, but that's not saying much. Well, apparently I did give the first one a 6.5. I guess I was janking the score up.
Who can remember?
You know, I think I did what a lot of fanboys do with that first one, which was you really want to like it. You're really excited and you come out of it and you're still like. You know, it's cognitive dissonance. Like
you keep that excitement alive, as though you
that movie had to be good. I just sat through it. Oh, I have to have liked it. I'm gonna give it a good score. And then, you know, after a couple of weeks pass, I'm like, oh yeah. You know, I mean, that's the way I was with Episode One, with the first Star Wars movie.
Really?
You know, when the first prequel came out, like I went and saw it, and then immediately bought another ticket and saw it again because I was so jazzed about having a new Star Wars movie. That's like. It's a new Star Wars movie. It has to be amazing. You know, and now I look back on it, and I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, it is weird sometimes where that's why I do my best to try and, like, not get too excited or too, like, pre-damning of anything,
right.
you know, because
right.
you never know. But like, I remember, and talk about movies I'm in the minority on, seeing that first Lord of the Rings movie. And like, not only was it getting all this amazing advance buzz, but Dave White, who is not a fan of like sword and sorcery, anything at all, loved it. Like,
he should. That movie's awesome.
Yeah, he adored it. So I want to think, wow, this is going to be great. And about half an hour in, I remember turning to my friend Tom going, is it just me or is this crazy boring? And for me, that whole movie felt like watching other people play Dungeons and Dragons. And so I to this day have never seen parts 2 and 3 because I hated 1 so much. I was like, I'm done.
Now, I will say that I understand. I mean, talk about a tangent we've gone off. I can say
on this show,
one of the problems, I can see one of the challenges, especially with Return of the King, I'm sorry, with Fellowship of the Ring, is that if you've never read those books, mm-hmm. you know, they start out the movie talking about the important quest that they have to go on.
Right.
And by the end of the film, they haven't really done much. Like, all right, so you lost Gandalf. Like, all right, what's next? Right. Oh, you broke the party up. I mean, really, it's almost like the first act of you end the movie on the first act.
Right.
Right. And I could see if you don't know anything about that or, you know, you're not. As a standalone movie, mm-hmm. it is kind of rough.
But it worked for Dave. You know, he was excited before 2 and 3 even came out. He was already like, oh, this is so great. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, those movies, I don't think those movies are perfect. I think that Return of the King with its 5 endings, right, it's kind of a problem. But, you know, I got choked up at the end of that movie. I think they're great. I love them. And you're totally wrong.
You and everybody else. you know, I realize the cheese stands alone on this one, but... Anyway, so yeah, Wrath of the Titans.
You know,
it is not as awful as the first remake of Clash of Titans, but it's still pretty bad.
It's not very good. You know, I didn't even really particularly like the way the monsters looked. Like, I didn't think that it was like the effects are fine, but I didn't think the design was very good. You know,
I liked the Cyclops.
The Cyclops was kind of cool, but you know, when that first thing shows up, that's supposed to be a chimera. You know, which, if you know your Greek mythology, it's got the head of a goat and the head of a lion and the tail of a snake. And it's almost halfway through that fight scene when the tail starts biting him. And I'm like, oh, that's what that is? Come on.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was just some thing.
Well, again, so many of the fight sequences are so jerkily edited that I didn't even know what was going on half the time. Like, who's hitting whom? Like, what's the point of impact? Where are they?
Now, there were some fight scenes in Clash of the Titans that I thought were really great. Like when the Greeks take on the giant scorpions in the original, in the one from a couple years back.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was awesome because I had this thought like,
that was actually pretty
cool. These Greek soldiers are badass. Yeah. These guys are awesome.
But, and I would have enjoyed it more in 2D because the 3D exactly.
That transfer was terrible. This one's not so bad.
No, right? it wasn't exceptional, but it wasn't. I was never thinking, oh, 3D is the worst. You know, which is the first one I think I was taking off my glasses half the time. It was so bad.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Sam's Burt Convy hair.
Or Kenny Effin' Powers.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You know, like they get this really good cast in there. The only one that really, to me, stands out with his performance is Bill Nighy.
Yeah.
I thought Bill Nighy is great. Like, he shows up, he's what, on screen for like 10 minutes tops?
If that.
And he's hilarious. But, and, you know, Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes, they're like sleepwalking through this.
No, totally. This is... Like, I think my joke on what the flick was, I like to think that Ralph Fiennes was taking script notes on Coriolanus in his trailer because they were just, their head is not in the game on this one because there's nothing for them to do. Liam Neeson literally is just like, I can't remember, there's one word he pronounces and he like stretches out the syllables and it just sounds like you fuel or something. I can't remember what it was. It was really cringing.
I think he's in danger of becoming the Gene Hackman of or the Michael Caine of our generation. Like, he's going to just kind of do whatever they send him. Take whatever
the quote is.
Which is too bad because I think Liam Neeson is great. His bit on Life's Too Short?
No.
Oh my God. So the first episode of Life's Too Short, this is the David Warwick show.
Right.
He comes in and it's on YouTube. Warwick Davis. Yeah, sorry. He comes in and wants to do improv comedy. Like he's telling, you know, this is the show that's done by
Ricky Gervais.
And he's telling Gervais and his partner, like, they want to do this. He wants to do comedy. And they start doing this improv. And it's so painful to watch. Like, he's so serious. And like, you know, well, okay, so say you're a greengrocer. What? I'm not a greengrocer. You know, or you're going to the doctor. And he's like, okay, he comes in and he's playing the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky Gervais says, what seems to be the trouble? And Neeson says, I have AIDS. It just stops the scene. And he's like, that's not funny. Well, what do you mean? It's you got, I can't even do it justice. It's so hilarious.
That show's been stacking up on my TiVo. I need to get caught up. But yeah, I mean, Liam Neeson is a terrific actor, but yeah, and even in the ridiculous action movies like the Takens, right, and the Unknowns
and the A-Team,
like A-T, yeah, the Wolf one, you know, right, the Gray. You know,
I loved that movie.
Yeah, he actually kind of, he brings it, you know. Yeah. But this one, it's
no, just he gives ridiculous. It his all, you know, and he kind of does that here, but you know, you know, you kind of, I mean, the problem is you look at a guy like him, or you know, these guys work together on Schindler's List, he and, right, and Ralph Fiennes,
right,
and you look at him and you're like, what are you guys doing?
Getting paid,
right? And I'd like doing. To see Danny Houston pick better scripts. Like, I think Danny Houston, yeah, has a lot of potential.
Although, you know, I need to see more movies where Danny Houston isn't the bad guy. Because, right, when Danny Houston appears in a, right, film, exactly, I immediately go, bad guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, it's the Alan Rickman effect, right?
Yes,
like,
totally.
As soon as you see Alan Rickman, all right,
like in guy. Like in Children of Men, that actually counted as a twist that Danny Houston wasn't the bad, right, guy. You know, I thought. I couldn't help noticing as, as... When Liam Neeson as Zeus gets captured and like they're draining his life essence or whatever, so his long hair and long beard are getting white and he's wearing, got this sort of flowy robe on. I was thinking, oh my god, he's Shazam.
He just needs like to, they turned him into Gandalf.
He needs to sit on a big throne, right, exactly, in a subway station, you know.
Exactly. Where's Billy Batson?
Totally. Right. But no, I did like Rosamund Pike as Queen Andromeda, yeah, because I like her in everything. Like, she's one of those actresses, she's where, great, like, I will see her in a movie that has nothing else going for it, and I will leave humming Rosamund Pike. Like, she, right, showed up and gave a performance and did something, right, that stuck with me, you know?
But then, like, at the end, they, like, force this...
Yes!
This love romance story. Moment. It's
like, where did that, like, come from?
I'm like, oh, it's the only girl? Well, he's got to kiss her.
Yeah, it's so tacked on and really undercuts how cool a... you know, warrior character that she was, you, right, know, like I was hoping that he was going to kiss her and she was going to like shove him off or, right, something, exactly, you know, kick his ass. That would have been great. So yeah, Wrath of the Titans, yeah, whatever. Yeah. The movie we liked this week is Goon.
Yeah. Now that's the movie with fighting to go see.
There you go. Yes. Yes. If you want to get, if you have a hankering for violence and a decent love story and a lot of laughs, this is the movie to check out. Why don't you describe what it is?
It is based on a true story.
Yes.
I can't remember the name of the guy that it's based on, but it's based on a guy.
Doug Smith, I think.
Doug Smith, who can't skate, can't play hockey, and gets a job on a hockey team as an enforcer, as a goon, because he can fight like a legend. He's you know, probably going to be one of the best enforcers they've ever seen. He, you know, learns to skate, learns to play hockey, and of course there's going to be the inevitable showdown with the aging enforcer, played by Liev Schreiber.
Right. With a super hot handlebar mustache.
Yeah, exactly. Wearing the facial hair he should have had as Sabretooth in the, right, X-Men Wolverine
movie.
I loved this movie. I thought it was hilarious, and a lot of people got mad at me for saying this. I think it holds up there with Slapshot.
I would say that it deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Slapshot, for sure. I mean, for me, and as far as hockey comedies, I mean, yes, people have pointed out there are hockey dramas, you know, there's Miracle. And something else, I forget what. But,
Mystery Alaska.
Maybe not that one. Mm-hmm. but yeah, no, it's really funny, and you know... when I like a sports movie, that is in no way endorsing that it knows anything about getting the sport right. I have no idea. Like, they could be completely making stuff up, and it would go right over my head. Like, you know, when the people were splitting hairs about Moneyball, and,
yeah,
you know, if that was true. I'm like, I don't care, right, frankly. You know, it might as well be Field of Dreams for me, like, as far as how divorced it is from my reality.
They cast some hockey players in it.
In Goon?
Yeah, in Goon. Like, I can't remember his name, but the black dude that plays... the guy that Liev Schreiber fights with at the beginning of the movie.
And right.
That Sean William Scott plays, you know, fights later, yes, in the movie. Like, he's a real enforcer type.
Funny.
He's a real player.
Well, and Jay Baruchel, the actor who is also in the film, co-wrote it with Evan Goldberg, and he apparently is a huge hockey fanatic.
Right. Which definitely shows here.
Yeah.
You know, he's got some of, you know, what I think are probably some of the filthiest lines of dialogue you've, yes, heard in years in film. So this is not a movie to take the kids to. But
I thought
it was hilarious. Really like this movie. And surprisingly sweet.
Very much so. I mean, the Sean William Scott character, and I think he's a really underrated and very funny comic actor. you know, yes, he is like this extraordinary bare knuckle brawler, but at the same time, so nice and polite and very and naive, and then he has this really sweet kind of love story with Allison Pill, who plays basically kind of like a hockey groupie, but not the usual two dimensional tacky right. hockey groupie. And it's a really like this is a profanity filmed violent hockey film you could take a date to.
Well, you know, and one of the things I liked about Scott's character in this, Doug the Thug,
right.
is that, you know, he plays this character who is dumb. He's not a smart guy.
Yeah.
You know, but he's not playing, you know, he doesn't go full retard. He's not as, he's not quite as Forrest Gump.
Right.
But he plays this guy who knows that he's not the smartest guy. You know, he comes from a family of doctors.
Right.
And he has, you know,
I
there's
feel
that,
his pain on that one.
You know, there's this moment that he has when he takes his family out to dinner after one of the games, mm-hmm. and his dad is giving him hell for playing hockey. Like, this is not,
it's a not
career,
a man's
right? this
job.
This is not a man's
yeah.
job. And he's, you know, and he has that moment where he's just like, this is my thing. This is what I can do.
Yeah.
And it's this, you know, a surprisingly powerful moment in what is otherwise a really crass, kind of crazy, violent hockey movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like it's this nice sports movie. You know, it's almost an inspirational movie passing itself off as an R-rated comedy, but it's right. not quite that inspirational, but it's still worth seeing.
Yeah. Or vice versa for
right.
that matter.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, absolutely worth seeing. And I don't know if it's getting a huge theatrical release, but is it still available as a,
I think it is still available
on demand.
Demand. Yeah.
On demand. Okay. So yeah. So yeah, definitely check out.
Yeah, certified fresh on the site. 79%.
Nice. Mirror, Mirror.
Now, see, I didn't think this movie was that bad. I actually kind of liked it.
Oh man. Well, okay. So we know, Mira, this is the Tarsem Singh directed. It's one of the two Snow White movies this year. This is the sort of comedic one. Julie Roberts plays the evil queen. Armie Hammer is the prince. And Lily Collins, who is the daughter of Phil, I right. found out, plays Snow White. Now, you and Christy thought that Armie Hammer was funny.
I thought he was great at this.
And I think y'all are on crack. I find him so... I think he's a terrific actor. I loved him in Social Network, even in J. Edgar, which was a not very good movie. I thought he was really engaging. I don't think he has any sense of comedy. You know?
Oh, I disagree. That scene where he gets the love potion, the puppy love potion... Mm. I thought that was hilarious. I thought that was a risk for him to take as an actor to go that over the top with it.
He commits, I'll grant you, but I cringed. It was,
oh, I thought it was hilarious.
It didn't work
I totally bought
me.
It. I thought he was hilarious.
So yeah, the movie as a whole, I felt like didn't really grasp onto what kind of comic tone it wanted to have.
I'll agree with that.
Like Nathan Lane, I think, can always just sort of unpacks his own shtick,
right.
and he's fine. And the dwarves, I found, were all really interestingly portrayed, and they're funny. But Julia Roberts, it does not know how to be this sort of like... She's playing a character that basically you want drag queens to dress as at Halloween.
Right.
Like, supposed to be, you know, the evil, over-the-top, you know, vain, you know, selfish, blah, blah, blah queen. And she doesn't have that...
Right.
You know, like
right.
I literally was thinking about like Faye Dunaway and Supergirl.
Yeah,
that's what they
exactly.
wanted in this, and
right,
she
exactly.
is
or
not...
Joan Crawford to go with another Faye Dunaway. Person,
right, exactly.
Like, that's what you expect. You don't quite get that out of her, and so I agree that that's a problem. There's a serious lack of chemistry between her and Lily Collins, between Julia Roberts and Armie Hammer, and between Lily Collins
and
Armie Hammer.
Yeah.
So I do agree with you there, but I think that the movie has enough pluses. We disagree on Armie Hammer, but Nathan Lane shows up. He's great.
Sure.
And I think that what they did with the dwarves is really good. I think what's really impressive here is that they managed to make distinct characters out of the seven dwarves.
And there's seven different personalities.
Seven different personalities.
Than the ones that we were used to.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought, I liked this a lot. I thought it was, I mean, not a lot. Don't get me wrong. I thought, I like them a lot.
Yes.
I thought that the movie was kind of fun. I think that it's a good, you know, and I'm probably now looking at this from the point of view of somebody who's got a kid.
Right.
I'm like, as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, this would be an all right movie to take the kid to.
You could take a kid to this. Yeah. And then I think I mentioned I would give it points for the fact that they've made, because there's so much swashbuckling and action
right.
stuff, there's enough to keep boys interested as well as girls. You
yeah.
know?
I mean, it's a princess movie that the kid, that all of the kids will like sitting through. I think it does have its problem. I think it's got... you know, problems with the pacing. And I think that, like you said, the direction meanders a little bit in that, you know, some of the scenes seem like they're supposed to be campy. Some of them seem a little bit more menacing than you'd expect. I feel like it doesn't all... It's not very cohesive.
No.
You know, and then there's the inexplicable Bollywood dance number at the end. but that being said, I had a good time. I found myself kind of enjoying it.
You know, I could see it being the kind of movie you'd stumble upon on cable and be like...
Eh. Right.
But, I actually... For a complicated reason, saw it twice. Ooh. And I just...
Yeah, see, I think that in that case, maybe familiarity would breed contempt.
No, but even after the first one, I was just like, this is... And I thought maybe the first one I saw it was not a complete cut, which is why I had to see it again. And no, that was all there. I was like, oh, okay, it's still not working.
See, I think that this, you know, as we were talking about going into movies without any expectations, mm-hmm. you know, I find that if I go into a movie... having watched the trailer, and it's something I'm really interested in and exciting about, it's really hard. It can be very difficult for me to stay objective. Mm-hmm. You know, my score for Clash of the Titans. Like,
sure.
I'll come out of something that I was super psyched about, and it can be difficult for me in the face of a bad movie to sometimes admit that it really was bad. But the flip side of that is I could go into a movie that I'm dreading.
Right.
And sit through it and think, oh, you know, this actually was okay. And that's kind of what I was having here. Yeah,
but I've had that happen lately. I mean, both 21 Jump Street and Jeff Who Lives at Home, I was excited about. And I liked
same thing. That, you know, but the movie like that for me last year was Warrior.
Oh, sure.
Like, I was dreading going to Warrior. Huh. And that was one of my favorite movies of the year.
Yeah, this one, I don't know. It's like, I mean, the first time I saw it, I thought, well, okay, look, Tarsem, at least, you know, he's this really interesting visual stylist. And, you know, I'm interested to see his take on the material and, you know, and working with a big star like Julia Roberts, etc. Right. So I was not dreading it the first time, but I was like, I just really think this isn't working, you know. And then when I saw it again, I thought, well, maybe they've touched it up or done something. They're like, nope, this is what I saw before, and it's still not working.
I did like the way it looked, though. I did like, I thought it was beautiful. I liked that it was this fantasy world. Definitely kind of traditional fantasy, but not the Disney-fied that we'd seen so many times. It really does set its own tone for a Snow White movie.
Somewhat. I think that what I was saying was, like, I don't feel like it's as separate from other fairy tale movies as, say, Immortals is from other, like, Clash of the Titans-y kind of movies. I'll buy that. You know? And also, it really bugged me that, like, I started noticing after a while that it's always snowing, but no one's ever covered
with snow.
No one's ever cold. No one's ever wearing a jacket. Like, there's a lot of running around in sleeves in this movie, and no one cares. And
It's blue. That's called bluebird skiing. That's when you ski and the sun's out.
You know, there's no visible, you know, breath, which that is no big deal. But I mean, literally, like you know, Snow White, when her sort of ninja outfit, she's all short sleeves. The prince is constantly being like stripped to his knickers, you know, and no one's ever shivering. You know,
well, yeah, because it's never that cold on the set.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like they didn't even bother to think about that whole issue. But anyway, and then also this week, so you still haven't seen Bully?
I still have not had a chance to see Bully. I'm definitely going to go see it, but I still haven't had a chance to.
Yeah, so Bully, you know, obviously, I fully endorse everything this movie is about. You know, I agree that bullying in schools is a big problem, that parents and teachers and educators and you know, administrators and the police need to take it more seriously, and that it can really screw up with kids at the most vulnerable points of their lives. And, you know, it's a thing that needs to be... You know, it needs to be addressed. It needs to be dealt with. That doesn't make Bully any better of a movie for arguing that point. It's not a very effective documentary. It doesn't work all that well on an emotional level, even though they're telling some very painful stories. And there are moments that are undeniably heartbreaking. But the filmmaking is so scattershot, where you're jumping back and forth from story to story with no real rhyme or reason. And you've got all these sort of like, you know, look at me, I'm directing tricks of like, you know, going out of focus and in focus and stuff. And, you know, so that aspect of it didn't work. And then it doesn't really work on an intellectual level. Like they don't ever find like a bully or a former bully to talk to try and, you know, delve into the psychology of where this comes from in the first place. There's not a single statistic in the movie about bullying in general.
Well, and it sounds like they never get into, is bullying worse now than it was.
Right. I mean, they touch upon, you know, well, you know, now you have Facebook and now you have texting and da da da, and I mean, and I, which is fine, but it just seems like a really wasted opportunity. And now I'm really also annoyed at the Weinstein Company, because Harvey Weinstein is a master of creating these big to-dos to get publicity.
Right.
So for the last month, all we've been hearing about is, oh, the MPAA gave it an R rating because they say the F word six times, and all these celebrities coming out and like championing the film. No, it should be PG-13. Blah, blah, blah. So what he has done is, rather than having this national conversation about bullying, which the movie should be inspiring, we're having another conversation about movie ratings.
Right.
You know, and apparently now what I'm hearing is they're going to release it. They're going to release it with a bleeped version anyway. So it's like, well, why didn't you just do that?
Because it's publicity. Come exactly. on, you know that. That's hiring, right?
Of course it is. But I'm just saying that. But he has made the discussion about something else and not about what the movie is about. And I just find that super irritating. You know. And so it's like, so there's this sort of, you know, rallying cry of like petitions and da da da. But it's all about the movie and not about the bullying.
Right. Right. Although, you know, you could argue that somebody seeing that movie, if it generates some minuscule bit of awareness.
No, look,
right?
I
mean, I don't want to be an apologist for a movie I haven't even seen.
No, look, I get it. I'm glad it exists. I'm glad that it's out there, and I hope that it does inspire this right. kind of conversation. But I just, for a movie that's getting this much exposure and is going to be like, you know, they're going to put it in schools or whatever over the course of its life on DVD right. and stuff. I just wish there was a better movie going out there to do it.
Right.
But if it leads to positive results, great. Right. I don't begrudge it any of that. That would be lovely. But I just have to say, it's my job as a film critic to say, yes, bravo for taking this subject on and all that stuff, but this isn't a very good movie.
Now, do you think that the kerfuffle about the rating is going to make any difference with the MPAA long term?
Probably not. You saw either. This film is not yet rated. Those guys live exactly. in a little bubble of their own. And you know, they're always going to lean towards giving big studio movies more of the benefit of the doubt than indie movies.
Right.
Because they are right. literally bought and paid for by the big studios. Like that's right. who controls the MPAA and they created this whole sham thing just so that there would no longer be these kind of local censors.
Yeah, although, you know, the flip side is, I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, mm-hmm. you know, you got to look back at the history of the MPAA. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's, yes, the dichotomy of what they're doing and of the way they treat large studios versus indie films. And, you know, what I absolutely will say is the hypocrisy of giving Hunger Games where teenagers die. Right. Young teenagers get killed mm-hmm. in the Hunger Games, a PG-13,
right.
and Bully gets an R. That is shocking yeah. hypocrisy.
And not to mention, like, straight sex versus gay sex right. or violence versus sex.
It's absolutely turned yeah. in, you know, like, their track record, especially in the last 10 years, is embarrassingly hypocritical.
Yeah.
But that being said, what's unfortunate and ironic is that the MPAA started out with as a not bad idea. Like, that was Jack Fellini trying to save Hollywood from the Hayes Code.
Right.
No, which, no, no. God forbid we had the Hayes Code, because that would be 1,000 times worse, oh, I think.
I granted. Right? And yeah, I think certainly it is a case of better the devil you know. Because, I mean, I lived in Dallas when Dallas still had the last of the, like, local ratings boards. You know, wow. where, like, there would be, like, tiny print in the ads right. in the papers that would say, like, you know, it was, like, not suitable or suitable except, you know, DV, right. blah, 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 or suitable. And they finally got shut down in, like, the 90s because the distributor of Much Ado About Nothing didn't get a chance to show them the film beforehand, so they gave it a not suitable. So then, like, this local publicist who I know had always thought they were ridiculous was like, you guys are seriously giving a not suitable to Much Ado About Nothing.
To Shakespeare.
Yeah, and so that's basically what shut them down. So I get, it's probably better that they exist than we go back to the whole band in Boston.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that they do need to clean up their act. I think that, that something needs to be done. Like, you know, it needs to be, at the very least, it needs to be a level playing field, right? Yeah. It has to be. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, for those people that are listening that haven't watched This Film Is Not Yet Rated, I mean, talk about something that'll get your blood to boil.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, hearing Matt and Trey from South Park talk about, you know, with their indie film, they just get ratings back and right. no notes or anything. And then when they did their South Park movie, they got detailed scene-by-scene notes.
And I love when Kirby Dick does the side-by-side comparisons of, like, this got an NC-17, this got an R. You know, right. it's bananas. But, you know, that said, I think that, where was I going with this?
I totally dragged you off.
No.
That being said, Bully's not that good a movie.
That being said, yes, Bully's not that good of a movie. But I just, The other thing, though, that, and Dave and I have talked about this in the past, is that for all of the, oh, you know, we've gotten rid of the Hays Code and now Hollywood is so, you know, now we're free to do whatever we want, there is still a very pervasive safety that is now just sort of self-enforced, more out of like, well, you know, audiences are going to be mad if they don't get married at the end, or if the murderer gets away with it, or whatever,
the conventional wisdom is that you don't want to challenge audiences outside of putting them in a film where they expect to be challenged,
right.
But you know, there's a reason they call it the Hollywood ending. I mean, it's you know, there are formulas and there are expectations.
What I'm saying is that, like, we, even without the Hays Code, people are very happy to make themselves do it, basically.
Yeah. You know? No, I agree.
You know, I mean, like, you wonder now, like, there was, and that's part of what makes that late 60s, early 70s moment so interesting, you know, was that filmmakers were kind of daring to, like, mess around with that. Like, you know, would you get to end Chinatown now the way they did in 1974? You know, things like that. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, I have there's a lot of discussions that Tim in my office and I have about that, especially that early that post Nixon, that Watergate era of filmmaking, where like you can see the movie, you can see the filmmakers that between Vietnam and Watergate are so disillusioned, and all of a sudden, like, all the big movies have just these bleak, awful endings. Like, oh yeah, I guess there's no point, you know. Like, you fight the good fight and you end up killed.
And for what?
And for what? Oh, they're just gonna replace me with some other drone,
right? And then Jaws, Rocky, and Star Wars.
And life is good.
None of that anymore. Right. Shush with your conspiracy theories.
People want to be happy at the movies.
Exactly. And throw their popcorn in glee. Anyway.
Whatever. Jaws is awesome.
Yeah, I know. I'm not. Look.
I know.
All those movies are terrific in their own way. It's just. But that.
Yes, I'm right there with you.
That's a thing that happened. All right. So in addition to checking out This Film Is Not Yet Rated, what would be your DVD recommendation?
My DVD recommendation is a movie that I'm planning to pick up and see, Corman's World.
Oh, yes.
Documentary about the great Roger Corman. Yes. Now, I'm sure that a lot of your listeners know who this is. But Roger Corman is probably the most influential director that
producer,
who you either haven't heard of or never saw any of his films. But this is the guy that if it wasn't for Roger Corman, we wouldn't have Martin Scorsese. We wouldn't have James Cameron. There's a lot of people who came up through his, you know, one of the things that Corman did, like, he was this great B movie producer, and he taught guys like Scorsese to shoot quickly, shoot on budget, shoot fast, shoot well.
Yeah. He gave Ron Howard his first directing break. You know, you can track Easy Rider back to the biker movies that he produced and or directed with Peter Fonda. He was this brilliant exploitation filmmaker, but who also mentored this whole new generation. Right. And taught
all these guys how to make movies that you would, you know, with a level of experience that you would never get in film school.
And as a distributor with New World Pictures, was like, you know, brought a lot of Truffaut's films to the U.S. And, you know, like, I remember gave Ken Russell the gig to direct, you know, Crimes of Passion. Like, he's got his hands in a lot of pies. He's a really interesting seminal figure in film who, you know, yes, he's also, you know, you look at the films he directed and they're all things like Zontar, The Thing from Venus. Or whatever. But, you know, yeah, he plays
That'll Be on role. The Stars, one of my favorite Corman movies.
with
the great John Saxon.
That film screened at Sundance in 2011, and I interviewed him and the film's director, Alex Singleton, I believe is her name. So if you Google, you can find that. He was very cool to talk to. My DVD pick this week is one of the films that was featured in my book, 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men. It's been kind of hard to find on DVD. Like, I know for a while you could only get it if you bought, like, this whole big box set that 20th Century Fox put out of their Best Picture winners. Did it actually win Best Picture? I think it was like the very first Oscar, so it won some sort of achievement award exists.
Yes, that's,
you know,
the special
for artistic something. Like that. Yes. Anyway, the film is F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, and if you have never seen a silent movie apart from The Artist, let's say, it's a great place to start. And even if you are well versed in silent cinema, you aren't thoroughly well versed until you've seen Sunrise. It is breathtakingly beautiful. It is a simple story about an unfaithful husband in the who lives in a rural area. A woman from the city beguiles him and tries to get him to murder his wife. He almost does it and realizes the mistake he's making. He and the wife spend a magical day together in the city and rekindle their love for one another, and it is so beautiful. And the stuff that Murnau does with the camera is so inventive and amazing. A lot of film scholars say that if sound had come in a year or two later, that the cinema would, the language of cinema would have advanced so much further, because people could do so much amazing stuff until they suddenly had to lock it all down right. And have that microphone, So this is one of the last, it came out in 1927, right? The same year as The Jazz Singer. So right at the end of the silent period, but it is so great. I mean, and this is not Homework. This is not Broccoli. It is just a movie that will blow you away. It is just a delight. So Sunrise, out on video, out on DVD this week. Pick it up. It's so great.
That's a good recommendation.
So golly, this has been a fun episode. Thank you for popping in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Where can we find you? Well, RottenTomatoes.com,
Rotten Tomatoes, of course. You can follow me on my seldomly updated Twitter feed, at Matchity. M-A-T-C-H-I-T-Y. You can see me spouting BS on What the Flick.
Indeed.
Unlike Ben, though, I usually see the movies.
Poor Ben.
He's going to have this rep.
I know. And it's like, we get busy. And people are like, oh, it's your job. Like, yes, but it's actually my job to see these other movies. And so,
the funny thing is, for me, my actual job is editor-in-chief at Rotten Tomatoes. Like, the What the Flick is, right. That's the side thing that I do.
Yeah, ditto with
for me. I'm doing, people like, here I am complaining about my job seeing movies, but outside of my 40 hours a week in the office or more than that, then I have to go and try and see movies.
Sure.
And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Right. And this is the thing that people never understand. Like, oh, you have to see movies. Like, yeah, you know what? I had to see every Twilight film.
Right. Yeah.
Every.
Yeah. What Dave always says, every time you see an ad on TV for a movie, you think, ugh, I don't want to see that. We're seeing.
Exactly. But you know what? It's still better than Digging Ditches.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Unless you love Digging Ditches, right. I apologize.
Yeah, more power to you. Ditches are important. The other weird thing is that people don't know often the hoops that we have to jump through to get to see these movies early enough to review them anyway, which is a whole other thing. It's not like they're just all sitting there waiting.
White
for
people
us.
Problem.
Totally. Yeah. So we'll stop complaining.
This is a first world problem.
Totally.
To be
clear. So I want to just mention, as always, folks, check out our friends in the podcast world, The Popcorn Mafia with Gray Drake, The Comedy Couch, Blowhard, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Showbiz Sandbox, Secretly Timid, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, and The Schmoes Know. You can like us at Facebook at our Linoleum Knife podcast page. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show on Get Glue, even though they've got us listed as a TV show. And I wonder if we can get stickers. I have to find out what's involved in that. I want some sticker action from Get Glue. And if you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show as well. And tell your friends. We have been, the tiniest bit climbing from week to week on our numbers, but we love more word of mouth. We love things getting out there. So if you enjoy the show, post it on your Facebook wall, tweet about it, tell people in the office who are bored and looking for something to do who have headphones, whatever it takes. That would be awesome. And next week's show is going to be very exciting. Dave will be back and we'll have a couple of special guests, and it's going to be a jamboree, so you do not want to miss it. But until next time, Matt Atchity, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you next time. Bye.